Welcome to the podcast series for AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology. I'm your host, Kara Hansel-Kehan. Today we'll discuss the article by Donner et al. Titled, Improving the Quality of Preclinical Research Echocardiography, Observations, Training, and Guidelines for Measurement. This article was published online April 20th, 2018. Joining me today are Deputy Editor Mary Lindsay, Lead author Daniel Donner, and content expert Lisandra De Castro Brash. Let's get started.
Thank you, Kara. This study focused on standardizing the quality of echocardiography in mice at one institute, which is timely with the current discussions of rigor and reproducibility. Dan, tell us what the impetus was to do this study.
Thanks, Mary. Well, actually, it was quite an organically motivated study. It was part of a broader commitment to addressing issues of reproducibility at our institute. What we really wanted to tease out was whether or not the variability inherent in how we traditionally train and learn basic research skills could also be contributing to the problem. And by traditional approaches to training, I mean sometimes it's called generational education, where you're passing knowledge and skills from say, senior research scientists to more junior research scientists, or sometimes even laterally from even new appointees, bringing in new information and new knowledge and skills and training other students and staff. But by whichever direction you're bringing that information to somebody else, it's generally by a very informal means that's not really quality controlled or standardized by any means.
I see. I really like that the Baker Institute has taken such an active role in helping to increase rigor and reproducibility within its institute. Lisandra, tell us why this was an important evaluation to make.
Well, very often we see variation between echo readers. I think anyone that has a lab that uses echo eventually reaches that point. And I believe this happens, especially if the readers have not received the same type of formal and professional training. I think training is not that difficult to obtain. It could be provided by the software manufacturers, and they will send a specialist to either perform on-site training or live online. We do that quite often here in my lab. And it is important for a lab to have their users properly trained, not only on the acquisition of the images, but also on the analysis. And sometimes people forget that. This is how you ensure your data has rigor and reproducibility.
I agree with that. My own laboratory has written out standard operating procedures on doing echo, and we quarterly evaluate and calibrate to make sure everyone not only reads, but also can acquire echo in the same way. So one thing that I noticed in this article was that the coefficients of variation among investigators dramatically reduced following training. Dan, what were the most critical insights that you found from doing the training program?
Well, first, implementing the short and formal training program was not at all as onerous as we expected it to be. We have a background in curriculum design, but our formal training model was by no means novel in nature. We outlined a truly tried and tested method of a short lecture-style presentation of guidelines, of a practical manual that was derived from guidelines that we'd agreed upon within the institute, and that was followed by an assessment by each of the participants in this study, or as we called them outside of the study, the trainees, and that was just an assessment of, in this case, 10 images of echocardiography, short axis M mode. And that was followed up by a one-on-one review with each of the participants. And that was actually a lot easier to put together and get the commitment from each of these researchers to follow through on than we expected.
I like how you commented that setting this program up was not onerous. And I think that's something that I want the listeners to take home from this, is the fact that actually setting up these quality control measures is not that hard to do, and it makes your data so much stronger. I want to talk a second about some guidelines that AJP Heart recently published on measuring cardiac physiology in mice. And this study here is a good example of following those guidelines. Lisandra, you're one of the co-authors for the guidelines. Can you tell us some highlights that are in that article?
Sure. The article provides best practice information regarding how to measure accurately cardiac physiology in mice. For example, on table 1, we listed variables to be measured when evaluating a number of cardiac pathologies, and that included aging, myocardial infarction, cardiomyopathies, etc. And something that I believe was very useful coming out of that article, we also produced a checklist for both authors and reviewers, and that's on table four. And that checklist regards minimal details that are needed for methods and results when reporting cardiac physiology. So hopefully, if people start following that checklist, it will be much easier for different labs to compare their data, because they will know for sure if they were using a similar protocol or not.
Thank you for giving us that overview, Lysandra. Dan, I wanted to ask you, when I read your article, I saw that you needed exemption from the ethical review for this study, which was obtained from the Hospital Ethics Committee. I hadn't really thought about that ahead of time, but this is both a mouse imaging study and as well as a human subject study. So what other tips could you give our listeners who may want to set up a similar training evaluation at their institution?
Well, you're right. This was certainly a human subject study, Mary, even more so than it was even an animal project. The imagery that we used for the assessment and for the design and implementation of that training, all of the examples that we used, they were actually derived from previous studies just to provide a nice spectrum of left ventricular masses to evaluate correlations against where they existed. But our initial human concerns stemmed from the potential for discomfort, frankly, in confronting our colleagues with the concerning degree of variability between them and really managing just how we go about being as honest and open about the first part of this process, which was the observation, and sort of humbly taking on this responsibility, acknowledging that in doing so, other institutes wouldn't necessarily have to replicate that first step of the process. Contrary to our expectations, the feedback was actually entirely positive, and the training was embraced by all of these researchers as really the opportunity that it was to develop self-confidence and data and to improve the sensitivity of our techniques to really answer our research questions most effectively and efficiently.
I see. It's definitely good to hear that the Baker Institute is producing echocardiography results that have high confidence. And so this training is a very good example. Lysandra, the investigators were blinded for the analysis. Can you tell us why this was important to do?
Yes, Mary, that's a very good question. I actually feel very strongly about this. I believe unbiased results can only come from a thorough study design that needs to include blinded data acquisition and analysis. Samples should always be coded to promote objective and impartial evaluations. And if possible, it would even be better if two blinded users could perform the data analysis, and then the average of the readings would be reported. And the type of study that then just published, it's a great example on how these types of standardization and calibration should be very frequent within our labs to make sure our data is as strong as possible.
I just wanted to acknowledge we completely agree with the importance of bias in addressing that. There's something else that I just wanted to say. When readers take a closer look at the paper, they'll notice that the first section or the first part of this, the study was really that broad observation and audit of the performance at the institute. And credit where credit's due, and I'll inject a little bit of my own positive bias in here. These are highly intelligent research scientists who just weren't provided the opportunity of a centralized, standardized source of methodology initially.
I think that's a very important component, is that for investigators not to think that this is a question of their scientific abilities, but this is just a way to standardize and make sure everybody's calibrated to produce the same results under the same circumstances. So I think this is a good tone to try to help investigators be more open to these kind of setups. Lysandra, one of the striking results of this study is that power analysis revealed sample sizes needed to detect differences reduced from 16 before intervention to a remarkable 7 after training. Can you discuss the implications of this reduction in sample size?
Sure, Mary. Wasn't that amazing that it was a reduction of 50%, actually more than 50%. I think this is a great example of how improving your methodology will reduce animal numbers, which will make better use of animals and reduce study time and costs. Overall, an optimized standard protocol will not only ensure robust and reproducible findings, but it will also promote the lab efficacy and productivity. For me, it was really striking, this piece of data that came of the paper. And just this should promote everyone to want to do the same in their own labs. Imagine the amount of money everyone would be saving if they could do this.
I was thinking the same thing. If the whole concept of rigor and reproducibility is hard for you to digest, then certainly having excellent data and less animal numbers because your data is so good should be a stimulus for wanting you to look into this kind of training program.
In terms of these guidelines that are now being published more frequently, and I know your guidelines, Mary and Lysandra, have recently been published in AJP, which were fantastic, which we're actually implementing in training programs now as well. Do you see there being any more discussion about how to properly implement those guidelines, or how to best translate those recommendations and those checklists and all of these really valuable components of your recommendations to being used properly and making sure that they're actually having the desired effect?
Dan, you raise an interesting discussion point. I can tell you that right now, the way the guidelines for AJP Heart are being written up, these are recommendations and not mandatory. It's a whole process to go through the publications committee, et cetera, to have recommendations then made into a mandatory submission. The other thing is, from a journal point of view, we balance out the need for rigor and reproducibility and giving enough methods that everyone understands what was done, with also making it not overly onerous for authors to submit manuscripts.
I would just like to add that manuscripts like this will really raise awareness, not only in the researchers that have to do something similar or do something similar in their labs, but will also raise awareness for reviewers. No one wants their data to be considered an outlier compared to their peers. So if the reviewers also know what they're supposed to be looking for, if they can look at the information they're provided and make sure it's a complete set of information, that will help not only the readers as well as the publishers and the reviewers who are peer reviewing the work.
I also think that when we talk about having the public understand the goal of research and the importance of research, I think that it goes a long way for building public trust to have these kind of protocols in place so that the data is as reproducible as it can be. Daniel Donner, thank you for submitting this work to AJP Heart. Lysandra De Castro-Bras, thank you for discussing it with us. Back to you, Kara.
You've been listening to an AJP Heart and Circulatory Physiology podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit us online at physiology.org/journal/AJP Heart.